How the hell did NVIDIA reach a market valuation of $4 trillion? On this episode of Invisible Machines, we're going to find out with some help from Stephen Witt, author of The Thinking Machine, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA, and the World's Most Coveted Microchip. I'm Josh Tyson, a contributing editor here at UX Magazine, and I'm joined as always by resident agentic AI visionary and OneReach.ai CEO Rob Wilson. Rob and I are co-authors of the bestseller Age of Invisible Machines, and this podcast is where we explore and expand on ideas from our book. Stephen's new book provides a captivating biography of NVIDIA's unconventional CEO, while also unpacking the surprising connection between NVIDIA's graphic cards and the neural networks that power today's large language models. Stephen is an award-winning author whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, Financial Times, The Wall Street Journal, and Rolling Stone, and today he gives us an intimate look at Huang's unique approach to innovation, his unwavering belief in his people, and how he pushes those people to deliver on projects that often seem improbable, impossible, or a bit of both. One of those employees is VP of Applied Research, Brian Catanzaro, who Rob and I recently talked to for an upcoming episode. Catanzaro was instrumental in connecting researchers with the parallel computing power of NVIDIA's graphics cards. As we discuss here with Stephen, Catanzaro also helped Huang see the groundbreaking connection between GPUs and AI. In this episode, we also talk about NVIDIA's next horizon, the Omniverse, and why AI-enhanced simulation is the future of business. To kick it off, however, let's get into the underreported events that led to the creation of ChatGPT. Enjoy this conversation with Stephen Witt. Please support our show by visiting our sponsors. This episode of Invisible Machines is brought to you by OneReach.ai. Building good AI is hard. OneReach.ai gives you turnkey private architecture and the tools your team needs for building AI agents that can do real work. Their powerful GSX platform lets you avoid vendor lock-in, use any LLM in the marketplace, build secure solutions with reliable guardrails, incorporate legacy software, and create production-ready automation with enterprise-grade safeguards. For anyone who is serious about automating their organization, the GSX platform from OneReach.ai has everything you need to get started. Learn more about orchestrating AI agents for your team by visiting OneReach.ai.
I think a lot of people think the whole story starts at OpenAI.
No.
And I thought maybe that's where we could start today. It's like, many people think that's the beginning of the story. And right. I thought, why don't you tell them the real beginning and where OpenAI actually came into the picture?
Yeah. So if we're talking about the origins of AI, we can say, first of all, that AI took a 70-year detour in the wrong direction. So in the 40s and 50s, neural networks, which are now the contemporary foundation of the software side of AI, date back to the 1940s. People were attempting to build computers that operated like human brains almost before computers existed. It had always been a model, and the first papers on what they called nervous networks were published in the 40s. Originally, they tried to build like electromechanical contraptions that were like literally physical electronic brains. That didn't go anywhere. That was too hard. And so that line of inquiry was more or less abandoned in the 60s. And all those machines were dismantled. I'd love to actually reconstruct one or find one someday, because I think that would be fascinating. But they were all basically disassembled. I don't think there's any that exist anymore. And so this became, AI became a field that chronically disappointed investors and scientists, overpromised and underdelivered for decades. Meanwhile, within AI, there was this very small, kind of really heretical maverick group of researchers who continued to try and build computers patterned after human brains. So AI was a backwater. And then within this backwater of AI was another, the backwater to the backwater of working with neural networks. It was extremely unpopular. These guys could not get $5,000 worth of funding. And it was really just seen as this kind of eccentric thing that these handful collection of mad scientists were doing. It was especially unpopular within the United States, and the chief AI kind of like researcher was probably Marvin Minsky. He directed funding away from neural networks and towards his preferred methods. And so it's not a coincidence, actually, that all of the pioneers in neural networks are not from the United States, right? So like Jeffrey Hinton, Jan LeCun, Joshua Bengio, they're from Canada or they're from Europe. They're not from the U.S. They couldn't get funding. So that's the software side of it, which people have been trying to get work since the 1980s. They needed a lot of data, and those data sets weren't really available for a long time either. But late, you know, in the 90s and especially the 2000s with the World Wide Web, bigger data sets became available. So those are two of the three pillars of AI. And then Jeffrey Hinton, he was like, you know, the one question we never thought to ask was, what if we took this brain and just gave it a million times more computing power? That was the third leg, and that was the thing they were really missing. Just an ultra-powerful computer to run the brain on. And that's what Jensen and NVIDIA built them, without even knowing that they needed it. So kind of all three sides didn't know that they needed the other two sides. It's honestly one of the most amazing confluences in the history of science. The neural network guys didn't know that they needed the parallel computing side. And Jensen and NVIDIA, they didn't know they needed AI. When they started building these systems and they made the list of possible users, they put like, you know, oil prospectors, people doing quantum physics, climate modeling. But the AI was not on that list of potential applications for their devices. So neither side knew that they needed one another. And it wasn't until 2012 when Hinton and his group retooled one of their neural networks to run on NVIDIA equipment that the paradigm shift happened, the breakthrough happened. Okay. So it was 2012. That was like the big bang.
Yeah.
And one of the people working, one of the three people who built that was a guy named Ilya Sutskever. He later ended up at OpenAI and kind of built ChatGPT and went on to conquer the planet. But OpenAI did not invent these systems. They did perfect them, I must say. They did really come forward with the first really consumer-facing product. It's striking that Google didn't do it because they had all the pieces in-house. I mean, Ilya Sutskever was working for Google. It's striking that they failed to make this work. But it was really the hardware side that was the missing piece. And this is why Jensen and NVIDIA, really, you could say, they catapulted us into the future. Because what they were building, nobody else was building it. And if they hadn't built it, we'd be 10 years behind.
So OpenAI, in some ways, was inevitable. Someone was gonna put these pieces together.
I think from 2012, from the time the neural network research group started running their stuff on NVIDIA equipment,
right,
that was, to me, the moment they got the airplane to fly for the first time. That was the moment, that was the paradigm shift in computing. And I do think it was inevitable from there that all the pieces were now in place and somebody was going to figure it out. I think that was inevitable. What's most striking is that the success of GPT is on the transformer architecture, which was also invented at Google.
Yeah.
So how the hell did they not win this? But it's a classic case, of innovator's dilemma. Because to start innovating with ChatGPT, Google would have had to attack and destroy their main product.
Yeah.
They would have had to, you know, start attacking their own search engine monopoly, which if the incumbent player is very hard to do. And so, you know, some upstart outsider does it for you and now is eclipsing you.
So how did that story go at OpenAI and NVIDIA? How did they meet? And
so basically, OpenAI was floundering. They were failing. You know, Elon Musk had founded OpenAI essentially to stave off the robot apocalypse. That was his stated purpose, right? We're afraid the AI systems are going to get too smart and wipe out humanity. So I'm going to start this nonprofit that's dedicated to preventing that from happening. Now, OpenAI today has morphed into something very different from that, but that was kind of the initial impetus. And at first, they were trying to build, you know, this engine that played the game Dota 2. And it was like, why are you guys building this? This is not a good use of your time. But Ilya had come over to OpenAI, and he went to a conference where Google presented the Transformer. And he got it instantly. This is like 2017, 2018, I want to say. And he was like, this transformer is going to change society. It's going to change the way AI works. And he came back to Google and he was like, we got to stop everything we're doing and build around the transformer. That's the future. Meanwhile, Elon Musk was like, you guys are getting nowhere. I'm getting out of here. And there was like a huge fight where Elon Musk actually basically picked up all his toys and left. And then tried to convince Ilya to, and all the rest of the executives to defect from OpenAI and come work for Tesla. But I think their feeling was, we don't get along with this guy. Like, we like Sam more. He's a little easier to get along with. I don't really want to work for Elon. It's too hard. And so really, I think the thing that made it work was just that they had Ilya and a couple other brilliant engineers there. We can say that OpenAI got lucky. I mean, it's not clear why they won versus Google or some one of Anthropic or one of the other half dozen startups doing this, except I think they just had a team of people that understood the power. Here's what they understood. This is called the bitter lesson of AI. The transformer in its kind of most simple form is like 20 lines of code. It is not a complex product. It is actually almost bafflingly stupid. You would think there's no way this could work. It's so
fractal.
Simple. Yeah, it's so simple. It's so simple. And what they realized was that the coder doesn't really have to do that much. Fancy code is not the limiting factor in what makes AI work. The limiting factor is data and especially computing power. And the one thing we can be sure of in AI, no matter what else we do, is that more data is coming and more computing power is coming. So whatever we build has to leverage those two things instead of trying to fight against it. And that's what Ilya and the team there got. That's what the Transformer team got too. And when they started to build systems that just simply harvest all the computing power that NVIDIA was building, throwing down the pipe, all the data coming in from all these different sources, that's when AI really got turbocharged. If we can think of the kind of Toronto moment in 2012 as like the Wright Brothers airplane, that this move to the transformer, that's like putting a jet engine on the airplane. Now suddenly this isn't just some rickety contraption we get off the ground every once in a while. Now it's like a thing that can travel around the world. And that's what the transformer was. And of course, Jensen saw it all coming and built gigantic computer systems just to feed these transformer systems. And that's really what made NVIDIA the most valuable company in the world.
Isn't that crazy? And that story was like a day for him, right? Like, Catanzaro comes in and
says,
we were actually on the phone with them, what, this week?
Brian or Jensen?
Brian. With Brian last week.
Yeah.
Last week, yeah.
Are you doing him as well?
Yeah. Just can't resist his hair.
Brian's hilarious, man. I mean, Brian is, so NVIDIA is very straight-laced. It is much closer to IBM than it is to, like, Google. Like, people, no one does ayahuasca, or if they do, they're not talking about it. No one's going to Burning Man. No one mentioned Burning. I interviewed 200 people at NVIDIA. Nobody brought up Burning Man, not once.
Shocking.
You know, and this is like in the heart of Silicon Valley. They all have families. They're all squares, basically. And Brian, I think, was one of these squares when he started at NVIDIA, right? He was a Mormon. He had four kids. He sang in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir or some kind of Mormon church choir. He'd been on mission, you know, and then I think he came to terms with the fact that he was gay and left his family and kind of started to live a more expressive kind of lifestyle, started to dress in a much more expressive way. so that by the time I met him, I was like, oh, this guy's like the oddball at NVIDIA. but what Brian saw was that, so NVIDIA had built these 3D graphics cards, right? And the thing that made it work as a business was that demand for better 3D graphics was infinite. No matter how good you made the 3D graphics, the customer, there was a certain kind of customer that was always like, I just want it to look better. Throw more processing power at it. I just want it to look hyper-realistic and I want it to be rendered in 1 second. Looks 1 millisecond, right? And Brian was, I think, one of the first people, certainly the first person I have heard of, to intuit that that same paradigm would exist for AI. So he was actually starting from a circuits perspective. Brian was most interested in the way the microchips worked. And from there, he said, what could we do with these microchips that would also have infinite demand. And he was like, to me, it was clear that the next application was going to be AI. No matter how hard, no matter how smart the computer became, it was obvious to me we were always going to demand that it be smarter. And that's what brought him to AI in like 2006, 2007, even before the neural networks.
Yeah. 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 I heard him speak in, I think it was 2019. It was part of what supercharged me. He was talking to librarians at Stanford. And he's like, we need data. Yeah. This is all about data. So like it's you said, he was trying to pull that leg of the stool in, going like, hey guys, like we got an algorithm that's done, but what can you guys do? And I actually hit him up with this. I didn't get much out of him, but I started seeing a pattern that I don't know if is really there, but I sometimes see patterns that are and aren't. But one was that Jensen with this sort of, let's just for lack of a better term, call it like quasi-flat org. And then him kind of sitting there in 2019, trying to solicit help from all of these, you know, different librarians at the time, going from, you know, stage to stage, trying to kind of light up all these threads. I couldn't help but like think, wow, I think when you think in multi-threaded world all the time, that you're like, you start to multi-thread your humans around you. You know, you're like, it's the framework for which you start doing things. You got Jensen, like, I don't have 7 direct reports. I have 30. Why? Because I make multi-threaded processors. I want a multi-threaded company. And here's Brian out there, like, trying to get all of these people to thread up and start using and inventing. Like, he probably got tired of trying to think of ways to use the chips. He's like, I need you guys to help me out here.
Well, here's the thing about Brian, at least in his reporting to me, he told me he's not a very good manager. And I would say that I have talked to some people who work for Brian, and it was maybe Jensen is.
It's not his jam, right? It's not what he's trying
it's
to
not
be.
His jam. He's a research scientist, and you know, it's interesting when Jensen. So Brian's. This is actually kind of Jensen's power, right? So Brian was not a favored employee. He was actually getting poor performance reports inside NVIDIA. And the core product that he had built was not viewed favorably.
Said that to us, did he?
Yeah. I have talked to other people on his team and they were like, yeah, we did not believe this guy was an effective leader, essentially. They really questioned both his capacity to manage and his like programming chops, basically. But he had the vision and none of them had it. And he was the visionary. We can think of him as like kind of the Steve Jobs of AI within NVIDIA. He was not the Wozniak, right? He was not Woz. He didn't, you know, and this is a company that puts a huge premium, more so than almost anywhere else, on technical chops, right? So he kind of couldn't get any traction for AI within NVIDIA. He was trying to tell everyone about it and they were like, what is this weird guy talking? Remember, this is 2012. AI has not succeeded for 60 years. Like, what are you talking about? But when he brought it to Jensen, Jensen just instantly got what Catanzaro was talking about. And then, like, essentially field promoted Brian to run NVIDIA's initiative, right? Which is amazing. I mean, but Brian was a low-level employee with bad performance reports. And suddenly he's in charge of the most important initiative in the company's history. And this is that flat org structure that NVIDIA has. It's almost impossible to imagine another company doing this. Jensen will put so much trust in his people. He will invest everything in his people. And then he will ride their ass into the ground until they deliver what he wants.
30 emails a day, he said. He said he gets 30
Brian
emails a day.
Here's something. 30.
So he will trust you, but then he will put expectations for delivery and performance that seem impossible to you. And he will scream at you, and he has screamed at Brian, if you don't get it done on time in the way he expects. So this is kind of the flip side of that, right? This is Jensen will believe in you. He will believe in your vision and he will give you resources and the runway you need to succeed, but he will not tolerate failure. You know, he will, you know, so it's it's quite a thing. You know, and Brian,
tough love.
What's that? Tough. It's tough love. I mean, it's gone beyond tough love.
Okay.
Because it is love. I mean, Jensen loves his employees. He loves them, and it's not fake. He truly loves. He truly loves his employees. Tough love implies that it's more than that. If he has an employee, he can kind of clock, I think, very quickly what this person's maximum capacity is.
Okay.
What their potential is. And he wants to make them achieve that potential. And part of that is riding them, right? Part of that is being really, really tough on them in the manner of like a stage parent, almost, like, or like a tough coach.
Picks in the drum instructor from Whiplash, kind of.
Precisely. Yeah. He's nicer than that.
But he can see that greatness, right? Like his whole rationale in that movie is that
within you, yeah.
And he wants you to get you there no matter what.
So many employees told me, "I achieved things I never thought I could achieve.
Yeah,
I went so much further than I ever thought was possible in my career." And not only that, but you know, now I have $600 billion. You know, because I stuck with NVIDIA, because I stuck with Jensen, and it was a generous employer. The stock options I was getting in 2011 and 2012, when the company looked like it was a rinky-dink manufacturer of video game equipment, is now the most valuable company in the world. And I have more money than I've ever dreamed of. But I don't want to stop working because now I see the vision of what this company still could be. Right?
Yeah, we got that from Brian that I kind of asked because he was, you know, we were relating to the fact that, you know, in the early days, he was kind of the crazy man in the room talking about AI. And I can relate to that. I was similar. And I was asking him, like, do you miss that now that, you know, there's a value there. You're kind of free. You know, there's less people talking about it, less noise. I'm like, do you go to the next thing? You know, do you go be the crazy guy on something else? Is that where you want to go? And he said, no, there's so much left to be done here.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, this is once in a generation technology. It's more than that. It's once every several hundred years, I think, that something this important comes along. You're not going to get another one of these in your lifetime.
No. Yeah.
And Jensen understood that instantly. He understood that in 2012 and 2013. He was clearing off the whiteboards and he would write on them OIALO. Once in a lifetime opportunity.
Nice. Yeah.
And so he got how important this was and that nothing like this was. People are too quick to move off AI. They're like, oh, quantum computing is the next big thing. No. Like, this is it, guys. Like, this is only going to happen once in our lifetimes. This is it. Right.
Yeah.
There's nothing else on the horizon in computing. Yeah. There's nothing else on the horizon of technology that looks like this.
And you're a quantum guy. You can kind of relate to that.
Oh, yeah, I've written about quantum, but quantum is, look, it'll be awesome if they ever get a quantum computer to work.
Right.
If they don't, who cares? Like, it's not going to change society in the way the AI is going to, I don't think. Yeah.
He was right.
I mean, quantum is, I see the quantum, I see investors making this mistake right now by bidding up the quantum stocks, all of which are shorts, by the way, because... Here's the thing. There's like 10 competing quantum stocks and they're all doing different hardware implementations, right?
Right.
So only one of those can succeed. Nine of them are going to be worthless, right? And probably all 10 on it, if I'm being realistic. I saw this happen when I used to work as an investor in the 2000s. I saw the same thing happen with alternative energy stocks, particularly fuel cell stocks got really hot for a while at these incredible valuations.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Yeah.
Cool random number generator.
Yeah, for sure. Well, my favorite is like Ion. I interviewed the guy from IonQ, Trapped Ion. And then he was like, within 6 months, I think we're going to have a huge breakthrough. I was like, okay, cool. 6 months later, that guy was no longer at the company. And, you know, Trapped Ion is now like...
That's a different kind of breakthrough. Yeah.
So the kind of like... failure to latch on. Look, quantum computing, someday they are going to get it to work. I'm 100% sure of that.
Oh, yeah.
But is it going to be in the next 2 years? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meanwhile,
the opportunity cost of not participating in the AI revolution is huge.
Right.
Right. And quantum is not actually an input into that in any meaningful way.
Yeah. Yeah, so where's Jensen on quantum? Just is it out of scope?
Well, it's funny that you ask. He has stated on the record that NVIDIA will not build a quantum computer. And earlier this year, he was like, I don't even understand why there's quantum computing stocks. I think we're 15 to 20 years away from building a quantum computer. And this made all the quantum computing stocks go down. Then somebody in his company, I think, pointed out to him, hey, Jensen, you know, we're selling a lot of software to these quantum computing guys. Like, maybe you should. So then he walked all those statements back, and now he's like, oh, yeah, quantum computing's great. NVIDIA's point of view is they don't want to do things that other people are doing. And in particular, they don't want to build a quantum computer because there's 20 people trying to do it. A little bit about the history of NVIDIA. They started building these graphics processing units in the mid-90s, okay? And there was a huge craze to do this. There were maybe 70 companies trying to build this, okay? And so it was, Jensen said, you know, in 10 years, there's only going to be one company doing this. It was a little bit like the Japanese movie Battle Royale, where all of the kids are sent to an island to fight to the death and only one can survive. That's what the GPU market looked like in the 90s. And Jensen was like, I'm going to be the survivor. I'm going to be the one who lives through this. The way they did that was that they listed all of the best employees at their competitors and they just ruthlessly poached them away. So much so that they actually got sued by their competitors constantly. Four of their competitors sued them for violation of basically a trademark infringement or for essentially inducing, you know, the people they'd stolen away to give up proprietary ideas. Most of those lawsuits were settled. But, you know, NVIDIA basically would do this thing they called brain extraction, where they'd pull the three smartest people out of their competitors and convince them to work for NVIDIA, and then those companies, their competitors, would collapse because they'd extracted their brains. So Jensen survived this, right? But it absolutely scarred him. And I think his point of view was, I'm not going to go be in Battle Royale again. I'm not going to go fight to the death with 30 other companies to be the only survivor. I lived through that by the skin of my teeth. I'm never doing it again. From now on, I only participate in arenas where basically I'm the only guy doing it. Like, I don't, even if I lose money, I'll lose money for 10 years building some system that nobody seems to want with no apparent customers just to not be on that Battle Royale Island anymore. Quantum computing right now is Battle Royale Island, right? There's 25 companies trying to do it. One will maybe. Will live, right? Jensen's not going to go there. He's not going to go fight the Battle Royale anymore. But what he will do is sell all the equipment to those guys having that fight.
Right.
So he has built a quantum computing platform inside NVIDIA that they're all customers for. So he'll do that happily, if that makes sense.
That totally makes sense.
You mentioned in the book that he's sort of like terrified of startups. And I was wondering if there's like kind of a duality within him and within the company in that, you know, I found it really interesting that like once they had that breakthrough with the RIVA 128 chip and were suddenly moving product, they, you know, immediately kind of coined this mantra of our company is 30 days from going out of business and like always kind of wanted to be operating almost in this startup mindset. But at the same time, wanting to be that one company at the top that there's, you know, a laggard trying to catch up with and other startups trying to disrupt. Is there sort of like a duality in that, like in trying to somehow inhabit the startup while also never have to worry about the startup again?
I'm going to give a long answer. You mentioned disruption. So disruption, this term was coined by Clayton Christensen, author of The Innovator's Dilemma. And Jensen was obsessed with this book. And he assigned it to all of his executives, and he hired Clayton Christensen as a consultant at NVIDIA. So I was like, oh, I better go read this book. Here's the fascinating thing about The Innovator's Dilemma, and you won't see it if you don't go to the source material. It is not a manual for startups. It is a counterinsurgency manual for managers at established firms who are facing competition from startups and have to survive. That's who the book is for. Okay. Because what Christensen had observed was that as soon as these tech companies got established, they kind of started to ignore the lower end of the market, the marginal customers, and they started to abandon those customers. And then competitors would come in to serve those customers and innovate upwards and destroy the company.
And like the Honda, the Honda thing.
Precisely. We're low tech, right? So Honda entered the U.S. automotive market. They couldn't compete initially in the 60s with the big three automakers. So they built a dirt bike, and GM looked at the dirt bike and they're like, this thing costs $800 and it earns a 2% profit margin and only teenagers are buying it. Why would we build a dirt bike? That's stupid. But what Christensen's observation was, sometimes it is correct to pursue smaller markets, lower margin markets, but investors and customers will yell at you for doing this. But this is, in fact, the correct thing to do, because if you don't do it, insurgent startup firms are going to raid your market from below. And this happened again and again and again in the tech industry. After Christensen published this book, tech companies in general got smarter about this. I can tell that, like, Mark Zuckerberg has absorbed the lessons of this book. This will seem hard to remember, but when Facebook bought Instagram, people were like, what is Mark Zuckerberg doing? This company has 18 employees, and he's paying billions of dollars for it. Is he crazy? No. No, right? Because Instagram is starting to raid his customer from below. He can see it happening, and he has to move fast. In the S&P 500, there has been less turnover of tech firms than there used to be. If we go back 10 years, actually many of the firms are the same now, which was certainly not true if we went back 20 or 30 years. And that's because tech companies have absorbed the lessons of this. And they're much better about identifying startup insurgents who are going to disrupt their business and moving quickly to either participate in the same space or more often just buying those companies outright. And so Jensen's paranoia is actually widely shared, I think, among Silicon Valley executives. And when Silicon Valley executives miss a disruptive technology, they have to scramble quickly now. That's what's happening at Google, right? Google failed to buy, basically, OpenAI or something like that. They thought they could build it in-house, but they weren't doing it successfully. And so now they have to scramble to catch up to ChatGPT, which is now more popular, by the way, than Wikipedia. ChatGPT is like the sixth most popular website. It's gaining ground on Google very rapidly.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw Google releasing now, like, basically chat in their search engine.
It's interesting because I think what happened, Google's core product has been deteriorating for years, right? Google search has been getting worse for a decade. And they're trying to roll out Gemini in the search bar function now. But it doesn't work because they've been betraying their customer for too long and nobody trusts Gemini. Nobody trusts your Google search results to be accurate. They do trust ChatGPT, though, much more so than Gemini. And I think simply because it's so stupid, but I actually just think it's because it's a different website with a different font.
Yeah.
So we're up to really just some guys at OpenAI, you know, Grok and go, holy crap, apparently, like, a lot of data that you process for a long time starts to look, you know, pretty incredible. And where is Jensen in the background? What is he doing while this is going on?
So Jensen's, remember, Jensen doesn't want to fight on the island. So his way of doing this was to build this supercomputing platform on top of the graphics cards called CUDA. And basically what CUDA is you buy a retail graphics card at the store that's supposed to power, like, Call of Duty or whatever, and you flick a switch and you turn it over, metaphorically speaking, and on the other side is a high-performance computing platform for doing science.
Right.
Okay? Yep. And this doesn't make any sense to investors because the scientific computing market is quite small, and what kind of scientist is going to go to Best Buy to buy a graphics card to do their research, right? Well, the answer is a marginal scientist. The answer is a scientist whose research is out of favor and who can't afford time on a conventional supercomputing platform.
Okay.
The answer is a mad scientist. And so Jensen is building equipment for mad scientists.
That's it.
Including the University of Toronto,
which isn't
Jeffrey
that different
Hinton
from
group.
Gamers.
No, not that different from gamers. But it's much smaller market. There's not that many mad scientists. It's tiny.
Yes.
And so nobody else is building this, and people like Jensen is nuts. But I think part of his point of view was, like, you know, these guys are marginal customers, but my thinking is maybe it's possible that one of them is going to make a big scientific breakthrough. I don't even know where it's going to come from, frankly. I don't know what scientific breakthrough I'm going to enable. I'm just certain that if I distribute computing power at ultra low cost to the scientific community, somehow, somewhere, that will unlock a scientific breakthrough. And that was correct. And the field in which it was unlocked was AI, which Jensen did not know and did not see coming. But as soon as he saw it happening, he pivoted his whole company basically overnight to focus on AI. So in 2013, Jensen had started in 2009, I believe, something called the GPU Technology Conference, where he went out to all the scientists and talked to them. So this is the other thing about Jensen, and this is kind of NVIDIA's secret. Jensen is great at talking to scientists. He is great at understanding what the bottlenecks are for scientists and where a computer might help them unlock new breakthroughs. I think he's probably the best person in the world at that. And he has been doing it more or less his entire career, even before he did NVIDIA. Even at LSI Logic, his first job in the 80s in Silicon Valley, when he was 20 in his 20s, this is what he did. So he gets all the scientists around him and he talks to them. He's so smart and he's so insightful that he can more or less, within moments, see what kind of tool he could build that will turbocharge the kind of science that they do. And then this is the true secret of NVIDIA. He will proceed to build them a tool and lose money doing it. He will lose money to serve the scientists. And he will lose money for years to do it. And he will build all sorts of products that are super complicated that serve these tiny niche scientific markets, just in the belief that someday one of these scientists might have some kind of breakthrough. And when that happens, then suddenly an entire scientific paradigm will be built around the NVIDIA computing platform.
Yes.
And lo and behold, this is indeed exactly what occurred with AI. Yeah. So that was the business strategy, but almost nobody got it, including many of Jensen's investors.
Okay.
So it's hard to do this. Investors don't like it when you have a long-duration product that loses money for 10 years.
I remember when I first heard, I can't tell you what year it was, but it's a long time ago, when I first heard of the concept, it was early of using graphics cards to process data, and it instantly made sense.
Yeah.
And it instantly, to me, made me wonder, like, why didn't I think of this? I just was not thinking, it was a graphics card. It just wasn't. I wasn't contemplating it, but the second somebody said it, I was like, boom. It was like this instant light bulb. Like, that makes sense.
Actually, it was not even Jensen who came up with it. It was outside of NVIDIA. People were, at least initially, academics were jerry-rigging his GPUs to get to the circuitry underneath. A guy named Ian Buck at Stanford built, he was a gamer, okay? So he jerry-rigged like 32... NVIDIA cards and a daisy chain to render the game Quake, one of the games in the Quake series, in like 8K. So it took up an entire wall. Okay. It looked amazing. And then he was like, God, I have just accidentally jerry-rigged a supercomputer here. And it only cost me like $6,000, which then supercomputing standards is like chump change. And so Buck built a new programming language that basically hacked the cards to open it up for scientific computing. And then Jensen saw what was happening. He just hired Buck in 2004. And so this was kind of the beginning of the CUDA initiative. Even Jensen, this was kind of Jensen's strength as an executive. He was like, wow, if people are doing these bootleg solutions to use my cards, there's got to be a market there. I should, instead of like complaining that they're hacking my cards, I got to embrace this community.
Yeah,
it's
like, he saw that spark going off, like the one that happened with me. And he's like, oh, that's not a graphics card. That's an AI card. Right. And because like that was the only thing stopping me from thinking about it was that it was so positioned as a graphics card instead of a processor.
Clayton Christensen in The Innovator's Dilemma says disruptive technologies often look like bootleg solutions using off the shelf components, which are repurposed for something other than their intended purpose. So he basically called this.
Wow. Yeah. So what do you think, what's next after CUDA, like after this sort of GPU gold rush, what do you see coming next?
I asked Jensen this question myself. Well, what's the new CUDA? What's the thing that you're plowing money into that's going to lose for 10 years before you finally dominate some platform? And his answer was Omniverse. He said that right away. Omniverse. Omniverse is a high fidelity physics simulator of our reality.
Yeah. Yep.
So the game engines simulate physics, but they actually do so in a very clumsy way.
Yeah.
So, but why? What's it for? Well, Jensen believes that the next $1 trillion plus in market capitalization that's going to come through for his company, he basically it's priced in now that he was going to have a dominant position in AI for the next 10 years. So if he wants his stock price to go up, he's got to find another place to go. For him, the answer is robotics. He believes we're at the beginning of what's going to be a 10 or 20 year gigantic robotics investment cycle. So let's say we want to do a robot that washes dishes in our house. With neural networks, we have to train it using reinforcement learning techniques. Now, one way we can do that is to have the robot hand sit at the dish at the sink and wash dishes all day. But that's an extremely expensive and time-consuming solution because it's going to break literally 10 million dishes. We're going to have to clean it up. So what do we do instead? What if we simulate the kitchen sink?
Exactly, yeah.
What if we simulate the dishwashing environment? It's hard to do, right? We have to get the physics of soap correct. We have to get the physics of like delicate china correct. The computers, the robot fingers must be extraordinarily sensitive. It's require a ton of computing power to do. But the, Jensen's, the fact that it's hard, that's what Jensen likes about it. Because he's not the only person who's going to be able to do this, going to be afford to do this, right? So we're going to create this ultra high fidelity digital physics simulation. And then we're going to, the robot can break 10 trillion dishes. Who cares? It's all code. It doesn't matter. Once we train the robot's brain in Omniverse, then we can download it and deploy it in a physical real world robot that will actually do these things, right? And so if I build this thing and it works, I've created a toll booth that every robot brain has to go through before it's deployed. Okay. And so this is how Jensen sees the next like $2 trillion in market capitalization coming from. Not only that, okay, so that's the training side of it. Then we have what we call the inference side or the deployment side. So most, when you go to ChatGPT, right, and you put in a request, it's not processed on your computer. A data pipe takes it to some gigantic data center somewhere in Texas or Virginia. It's processed and sent back to you, right? And there's a lag when we do that. Right, there's a lag, you know, transferring the data and getting it back. Robots can't have that lag. We can't have the robot sitting there washing the dish and trying to throw back all the data to Texas and getting it back. It can't work through the cloud. So we call this need edge computing. The robot has to process it in real time, physically at the sink. All right, who's going to make the edge chips? Well, NVIDIA wants to make them. Right. And so that's the other way they can get $1 trillion is by building. Not only do we train it, its brain in our Omniverse solution, then once we build the robot, maybe we can deploy an NVIDIA Edge chip that is its physical brain on site. NVIDIA already makes these. Right. It's edge computing chip. Probably the biggest one would be the brain of the Nintendo Switch. But it also does a lot of this in like automotive, another area where we can't have lag. We can't have our car, when it's turning, go try and communicate with Texas in a split second. We need the chip in the car, and we need to do the inference in the car. And so Jensen is looking to establish a dominant footprint there as well. I think he's ahead. I can tell when I... Let me put it this way. When I hear Jensen talk about this stuff, and when I hear the CEOs of other chip companies talk about this stuff, it's clear that Jensen is just thinking harder.
He's been thinking about it possibly since like the 90s, right? Like when they switched, when the NV1 debacle kind of hit, then they were able to build an emulator, right? And that seems like a core piece of their success moving forward, is to be able to run simulations instead of spending money on prototypes.
They have understood the power of simulation more than I think almost any company in history.
And that's the key. And I think it's also the power of thinking in a multi-thread, like it's a different model. You know, people think linearly, right? And you can see he's thinking laterally, not just on chips, but on organizations and everything he's doing. And so to understand how to make these systems more reliable, simulation is the answer. It's repetition. Have them do it a million times before they do it.
Right.
And then do it, right? That's going to be the key, which is which no one's going to want to wait for that to be done in series. Everybody is going to want that to be done in parallel. It makes sense. I want 1,000 simulations. I said this a long time ago. Somebody's going to make some device. I forget how it manifests, but like imagine it's a pendant hanging, you know, around your neck, and you're going to walk down the street and it's going to capture audio and video of what happened up to that point. And you'll be able to rewind and see, oh, what did they say? And, oh, was that my best friend? But you'll also be able to then just generate future realities of what you could do next, but you'll be able to watch it because you'll have the video from the past, right? That essentially like can reconstruct like, oh, what if I turned right? What if I turned left? And you can watch a little movie of possible futures, right? Now, granted, will they be like accurate futures? No, they'll just be these possible futures, right? That you can explore and you go, well, each one's simulating like your life and what you could do. And I think that, you know, you need physics. The problem with simulations is the laws of physics apply to us here. If you're going to simulate the physical world, you need those laws to apply. And yeah. I get it. I think simulation, it's not about models not making mistakes. It's about models simulating what they do and learning from mistakes without actually doing it in the physical world.
Yeah. I mean, this is the other thing. It's very hard to build the Omniverse. It's really hard to build a digital physics simulator with sufficient fidelity that you can deploy the outcomes in the real world. That is, it actually sounds almost impossible. That's what Jensen loves about it, right? I mean, if it's that hard, he's the only one who's going to try. And the need for such a thing is, if you did build it, would be incredible, right? So that's what Jensen, that's not fighting on the island. That's, you're on your own building this thing. And that's what he wants, you know?
Well, we have this concept we call OAGI, which is like the idea that, you know, AGI is not relevant. What's relevant is enough intelligence within your company to do the tasks that you want to do. You don't need to know everything. You just need to know what you need to know to do the things that you need to automate. And I think it's the same thing here. You don't need to simulate anything in the world. You don't need, you know, to simulate any possibility. You just need to simulate, you know, the possibility that's relative to the thing you're trying to do. And so I think, you know, yeah, will it, you know, will all the laws of physics, will you be able to simulate anything someday? Doesn't need to, though, to be incredibly useful.
Yeah. So this is like, I didn't get what Jensen was talking about when he brought up Omniverse at first. I was like, what? It took me about 6 months to reframe it in my own terms and get it.
Right.
And I think that was probably very true of CUDA at first. People did not get what he was trying to do at all. You know, Jensen is a great public...
They never tried to farm off processes to it. A graphics chip before
CPU.
There was no
such market basically existed, right? Outside of the only people who had experience doing that were video game developers mostly.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it makes sense logically. Oh, it can multi thread, but how the heck do I hand it processes? Like, how do I do that?
It's very hard. Well, this is the thing. CUDA's hard to program,
right?
It's harder than programming in serial CPU. And, this was the reason that parallel computing solutions had actually existed since the 80s, but nobody used them because they were just waiting for Intel to show up 2 years later with a faster chip. Like, why am I going to retool all my code when I could just sit around and do nothing and then Intel is going to double the speed of my computer? Like, why do I need to optimize my code? What does it matter? The computer's just going to get faster. I'm not worried about it. But what happened was that Intel and the chip manufacturing industry had shrunk the transistor by so much that there was actually no room left to shrink it, basically. Once you got down to like 10 atoms in width or lower, the transistors would get compromised and leak electricity. And so you needed this other solution. But until that happened for a long time, it didn't work.
Well, it seems like so many businesses right now where AI is concerned are really focused on automating existing processes or maybe improving them through automation. But like what you're describing, and I think we talk about it in our book too, is like the more value laden layer of AI comes when you can start predicting business outcomes. So you're not creating automations for things that you're already doing in your company. You're deciding like what things should we automate next and why, and you're doing it without having to move things around in the real world as much.
There's two things, right? There's new products So that's a completely, there's new AI products that will, that are, that's, and that's like, you know, kind of like a completely open field. What am I going to pay for that involves AI in the future? I don't know. I'm sure I will, but I don't know what it's going to look like or what it is. And then there's existing businesses who want to use AI to kind of like wring out marginal improvements in productivity. The existing businesses have to be careful though, because they're going to start getting disrupted by the new products, right? So there's both. How do I make this, how do I make my firm more efficient using AI? But also the more important question that I think a number of executives will miss, which is, how do I fight the counterinsurgency, right? How do I prevent my entire business line from being disrupted by some AI model that obviates or even obsoletes what I do?
Startup.
Yep.
I'd love to ask Jensen a question, which is, if there was an AI that could take over the world, right? Because I know he's pretty anti this concept.
Yeah.
I want to know how many chips they would need and how much electricity it would take.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. Like, is there some kind of limit to intelligence? Is there a limit to, like, how smart we can get? You know, do we just run out of frontiers of mathematics or physics? We solve everything and that's that. It doesn't seem like we've ever come close. And in fact, the highest IQ individuals of all time, Einstein or like von Neumann, rather than solving anything, I mean, they did solve stuff, but every time they solved something, it actually opened a whole new branch of science. Right? So it seems like when we have very high intelligence people who apply themselves to physics and you know, mathematics problems, they expand the size of the field rather than shrinking it or solving anything in a permanent way, right? So is that a perpetual thing? Does that always happen? Does it just constantly get more complicated? Or are we going to just kind of like reach a kind of like permanent solution for all our entire physical reality? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not smart enough to answer it. But it's kind of an open question as these systems get smarter. You know, that's kind of a separate question from like, are these things dangerous? I think they are, but Jensen doesn't think so. You know, I think they're dangerous is because, you know, it's the same reason that Jeff Hinton thinks they're dangerous. You might inadvertently introduce some kind of survival instinct into the machine. And when that happens, like, what does that do for us? We were very dangerous for chimpanzees and gorillas without even trying.
Dangerous to each other.
Dangerous to each other. Yeah, that's the other thing.
One that night.
So,
yeah. Hopefully we'll make good pets, right?
I think Jensen is overly optimistic or downplaying the risk that these systems pose to us.
Yeah.
But like Hinton, I will also say Jensen's very smart. I mean, he's smarter than me. And I think if he saw this as a risk, he would not hide it. So I don't know.
When we talked last time, you mentioned that, you know, the closer you get to the fractal, like the simplicity, right?
Yeah.
The less afraid you become, because you just go, well, this thing's simple. Like, yeah, this bush could grow in any direction. It's unpredictable, but it's still a bush, and it's still rooted to the ground. It's not going to walk around and disrupt anything. But yeah, it might kill your flowers.
Right. So the hardware guys, they see this as a machine that does math. They see it as an engine that executes, you know, 10 zillion matrix multiplication operations per second. That's what they see. The software guys see it totally differently. They see it as an emergent machine consciousness, right? So it's a little bit like asking, what is your brain? Well, if I study brain cells under a microscope, it doesn't look very impressive. You know, it's, there's one neuron here. I mean, it's cool what it does, but it wouldn't inform you about the mysteries of the human species or consciousness or intelligence by looking at brain cells under a microscope. You just wouldn't, you know. So where do you cross that threshold from, all right, I'm the hardware guy, here's what it looks like to me. It's matrix multiplication operations. Does it matter if I do a million or a trillion? Like, what difference does that make? Whereas the guys interacting from like the monitor down, they're seeing something very different. They're like, this thing is alive, right? By the way, we have not resolved this question for human beings, right? So, or organisms. So at what point along the evolutionary chain, if I'm starting out with a organism, primitive organism, like a single neuron, to our highly complicated brains, where along there are we going to say, oh, that thing has crossed the threshold and is now intelligent, is now conscious? Yeah, I don't have an answer for that. I don't think anyone does. So to me, the only thing we can say for sure is, all right, let's say it's running hardware and doing math. Like, who cares? We can be completely agnostic about what it's actually doing under the hood. We can only interact with it from the front down. And if it seems smart when we're interacting it from the front down, I think we have to take that under advisement. You know, that seems like it's smart to us. You know, what else do you ask for?
Yeah. Well, this was awesome. I really enjoyed this conversation. I know you're on a tour of many of these, so hopefully you enjoyed it as well.
No, I mean, like I say, this is actually, I love doing this. So thank you so much for your interest. And I hope we find the right audience here as well.
Yeah,
awesome. For sure. Okay. Yeah, thank you. All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast, too, on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog, and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the U.S. and in Ukraine, Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokolkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week. Owagi.